I think you're a cruel, selfish, heartless man. You're also blind, stupid, and inconsiderate. I deserve to be treated an awful lot better than you've treated me, and you know what? So does Dorothy. And before you start shirking your responsibility for the way that you treat people and blaming it on your mother and your so-called neurosis, let me tell you, the reason you have two women on a string is that it flatters your disgusting. Blaming it on your mother and your so-called neurosis. And blaming it on your mother and your so-called neurosis. Let me tell you, the reason you have two women on a string is that it flatters your disgusting ego.
It's always like this. Sooner or later, my mother comes into it.
Why are the stars always winking and blinking above? What makes a fella start thinking of falling in love?
It's not the season, the reason is plain as a moon. It's just Elmer's tune.
Once upon a time, there was a woman who lived in London, and her name was Phyllis Elmer, but her real name was Elsie. I've set out a series of her photographs here on the table in front of me, like playing cards in a hand of poker. Is this a royal straight flush or an ordinary straight-faced bluff? There's the young flapper posed in front of a trompe l'oeil backdrop. The 70-year-old standing with her husband by a fireplace in St. John's. The pictures of bombed-out London, marked past by the censor. She kept everything. Diaries, dance cards, the torn-up photo of a lover. She kept the pieces. The wristwatch of the Australian aviator, the man she might have married if he hadn't been shot down over the English Channel, the ration book, the pressed flower corsage, the fortune cookie.
My fortune, you will be a princess. You'll marry a prince and live happily ever after.
Well, all it really says is you will have good luck in your personal affairs.
I don't think it ever came across to us, I mean, as children, that Auntie Elsie was embroidering the facts.
We just purely had to go by what Mum told us about her, didn't we?
Poor thing was probably hampered, wasn't she, in those days, by all her circumstances. She obviously had the intelligence and the looks and the social ability. The one thing she lacked, unfortunately, was the background. So she, I suppose she had to invent it.
I wonder where she got it from, which of her parents.
I think the most frightening was the buzz bombs.
They were terrifying.
You could hear them coming. You couldn't mistake it. It was a very clear sound. And when the engine stopped, you knew...
They cut out.
They cut out. When you don't hear them is when they're about to drop.
Yeah.
If you heard it stop, as it were.
That's all there was to it.
It was all right all the time you heard them going. But when they stopped, if it was anywhere near you, well, you knew you were going to get it.
It was just such a bomb, she said, that blew up her past. Killed both her parents, she said.
Why would she say that?
Leaving her an only child.
I suppose she didn't like them to know that we were her family.
32 years old, blonde, single, in London, in World War II.
And yet we weren't common.
With no family to trace her footsteps back.
We weren't nasty people. We're just an ordinary little working class.
We didn't know that you never knew anything about us all these years.
She just didn't know what to do about us. And that was it.
I don't think you ever allow yourself to empathize with how I feel. Over and over you ask for my patience. You say you're going to be weird because of her or because of the documentary or because of her again or because of a new documentary, and I accept that and I wait. Well, I'm sick of waiting.
Excuse me, I'm looking for number 25 Gwendor Road.
Gwenda?
Yes.
Gwenda, wait a minute.
What I'm looking for, this was the address of a woman I'm researching, a woman who lived here in the 40s at number 25 Gwendor Road.
Yes.
It's as if it should be there, you see?
Yes, well, those were all bombed. I mean, those have been like that for 50 years. That is not a natural green place. It's grown up since the bombing, and we had whatchamacallit housing on it.
Oh, because she lived there in, I think, the late 1930s, early 1940s, perhaps 1940-41. Phyllis Elmer.
Yes, I don't know the name. I've lived here for 30 years, but I know quite a lot of people round about.
February 14th, 1939. Dear Miss Elmer, further to our recent interview, at the moment I see no great scope for you on the exhibition promotion side of our business, but I am prepared to start you at £5 per week on the stand-fitting side, with promise of an increase immediately you make good on it. If you accept, the sooner you can commence work with us, the better. Yours faithfully, Ewart Watson Exhibitions Limited, 19 Charing Cross Road.
I mean, she would have had to have started work at about the age of 14. I mean, very few girls stayed on at school beyond the age of 14. And since the majority of families were hard up, I mean, she had to get out to work and get a job very quickly. And the actual material expectations of a young, intelligent, working-class woman in the 1930s were very limited.
Oh, she was wonderful. My sister. She was about 19 when she left home. I was only a very young child then. But my dad, I think he adored her. He always thought of Elsie. But he felt he didn't fit in, you see. She had these friends that were... They were above us. She had a good life. She made herself a good life and met nice people. And we were just ordinary working-class people.
Was that why she left home, do you think, to better herself?
Oh, yes, definitely. She wanted to be something better than that, to be staying at home and getting married to someone, you know, some local boy. Oh, no, she didn't want that. I don't know where she got it from. I don't know, honestly. It must have been the family somewhere.
Take what you do.
It's the way hot she do it.
Take what you do.
It's the way hot she do it.
Think what you do.
It's the way hot you do it.
That's what gets me so.
Mama, mama.
We are interrupting our program to bring you a news clip.
The following official communique has been issued from 10 Downing Street. At 9 a.m. this morning, His Majesty's Ambassador in Berlin...
Sunday, September 3rd, 1939. War declared 11:15. Air raid, 11:30.
I felt someone pulling me out of bed, and I heard the sirens. That was Mother. Quick, she said, there's an air raid, you know. The war has just been declared. She said, and there's planes overhead. So we got out, and we all went out in the garden and looked and watched. You know, we didn't go into any shelters or anything.
Look at those.
Oh, yes, boys.
Bomber crashed, 12:30. I crashed, 1 o'clock. Injured face and right leg, taken to Hampstead Hospital, confined to bed.
Well, I was very excited when the war started.
Yes,
I remember my mother crying and my father swearing. And I remember thinking, what's wrong with them being upset like that? It was going to be exciting.
This went on, you know, I mean, every night, you know, we used to have raids, you know what it's like. But Mum and I used to sleep underneath the table in the dining room because you felt safe underneath something, you know.
And all I could hear was the ack-ack guns going off, big, big guns we had, you know. I said, I can't do this. I cannot be enclosed and can't see what's going on here. I'll go mad. And so I joined as an air raid warden.
I was in the civil defence, the ARP,
I mean, the civil defence was big in London. But we worked hard because you had long shifts and a lot of burned people that were burned because they dropped the phosphorus bombs.
I went in the army because I felt that I wanted to fight for the country. We were with the heavy AK-AK 3.7s and 4.6 guns. I was a sergeant in charge of about 100 girls. We used to plot the planes coming in.
Well, of course, it wasn't normal living by any means. I suppose we really ran on adrenaline.
Yeah, it was a funny kind of life to lead. Well away from your parents and, you just didn't know whether you would be here the next week.
Saturday, September 16th. Allowed to go home from hospital, but limping with much pain. Quite alone.
London Pride has been handed down to us. London Pride is a flower that's free. London Pride means our own dear town to us, and our pride it forever will be.
Are we here?
Well, it's number 27.
Want to come up for a cigarette and a drink?
Oh, really? You must be awfully tired.
No, I'm not. Come see my room. I've only had a place of my own for a week. It's a new toy.
Saturday, September 23rd. Petrol rations started. Had dinner with Don after pictures. Saw The Spy in Black.
Well, this is jolly.
Sit down, I'll get your drink.
Thanks.
The imaginative possibilities of growing up as a young woman, working class woman in the 1930s, were huge.
Say when?
Oh, when?
They were reading about romance, they were going to the movies and imagining lives very, very different from their mothers. If you think of the, Jean Harlow or Marlene Dietrich, the heroines of the 30s, they weren't exactly domestic women and they weren't domestic romances.
Would you be shocked if I put on something more comfortable?
I'll try to survive.
And the other very important thing was that this was the generation that was growing up with contraceptives, which were cheap and available. And you could imagine a life as a woman without a child every year. That was the absolutely crucial thing, I think.
I want to be free. I want to be gay and have fun. Life's short, and I want to live while I'm alive.
That's the way I feel, too.
Hey, lady, when the day is dawning, see the policeman yawning on his lonely bee.
I think I'd better go.
Bless you.
I really should.
Hear your footsteps echo in the empty street.
Tuesday, Bill. Wednesday, Maurice. Thursday, Ernest. Friday, Don. Awful evening. Saturday, lunch with FH. Sunday, lunch with Edgar. Concert with Bill. Dinner with FH. Proposal of marriage from FH.
Every blitz, your resistance toughening from the rips to the anchor and crown. Nothing ever could override the pride of London town.
Wednesday, September 25th, 1940. My birthday. Flowers arrived from Basel. Lunch with Herbert at Scott's. Missed Ernest at 4:30. House evacuated. Stayed in Hotel Queen. Dinner with champagne. Slept on settee there. Many bombs. Nearby windows broken.
Have you seen that one before?
No.
Now, I think that's just before your dad went off to war.
So that's...
That's Toby, the Newfoundland dog.
And I remember standing very proudly on the front steps while Dad took the picture.
Is that you there?
Yes. But it's all so long ago, Christopher. I mean, we're talking 55 years ago when he went away. And 50 years ago when he came back. So it's... The memories are snapshots. They're not a moving picture.
Well, give me another snapshot.
I remember... I remember the day he went off to war. Because I remember the men marching down Long's Hill. I guess I was 5. And I remember standing on the sidewalk, watching Lewis, and I had a red coat with a piece of red and white ribbon. And he's somewhere in the front line of a rank of 8 or 10 across. And he had a herringbone tweed coat with a belt. And he looked really quite smashing. But I don't think when my brother went off to war that I really had any sense of the danger. Just the feeling of loss and, as I say, the anxiety that it caused within the family. And it seemed to me to be such a huge crowd.
Young Newfoundlanders.
Young Newfoundlanders, yes, marching away together.
Tuesday, October 1st, 1940. Mary called at 4:40 and took me to a picture, Gone with the Wind. Dinner, and 11 o'clock on to Paradise Club with Veronica and Willie. Home together for late meal. We lay on top of bed, fully clothed, until the telephone rang. Feel terribly in love with Murray. Wednesday, 7 o'clock, Captain Basil Smythe, dinner dance. Heard Nightingale at 2 a.m. in Berkeley Square. Marvellous evening.
She just had that way with her, dear, like some girls do. And some girls are attractive to men, and no doubt about it. She's very attractive, your mother.
Thursday, met French officer. Dinner, should have been at French Club, but this place bombed. Very serious air raids all night. Fires burning. Renee stayed. Left at 5:30 in the morning.
Oh, yes, it was a romantic time. You see, you were young. And, well...
David on leave. Walked in park. Lunch at Silver Grill. Supper dance at Romero's. Home at 3:30 in the morning.
It was all great excitement. Meeting people that we would never have known. People from New Zealand and Canada and Newfoundland and Australia. All the dances that you went to, you met all these kind of people.
The whole world was sort of stirred up like a great big stew, and everybody was somewhere different and not, you know, doing things that they never expected to do.
And there were 10 guys to one girl. I mean, if somebody said to me, you can live at any period that you like, I would have lived, been that age and gone through exactly what I did then.
You lived your life in case you weren't there next day. Why worry about tomorrow? Why not be here?
BBC Home Service. Good morning, everybody. Here is the first news bulletin for today, and this is Alan Howland reading it. German air attacks on this country last night were widespread but not heavy.
Saturday, October 5th, up at 9:30. David is still asleep. Did shopping and tea at home.
1642. Can I help you?
Yes, I hope so. I'm calling from Canada. And
yep.
I'm researching the Second World War.
Okay.
At 6:30, went to Overseas Club with Davity.
And I have the wristwatch of an Australian flyer who was shot down over the English Channel during the war.
Okay.
Bombs dropped very close by as we tried to leave.
And there's a number and three letters engraved on the back.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you can tell me what they might mean.
Waited for quiet period and went home with Davity after club people had been worrying us to go to the shelter.
Fine. What three letters are they?
ATP.
ATP. Do you know the name of this fighter at all?
Yes, his name was David Fletcher, so it's not his initials.
No.
Davity leaves at 12 Monday from St. Pancras Station, or what is left of it.
Okay. Look, you'd have to leave it with me. I'd have to do some looking for you. I've got a book here on military abbreviations. If you'd like to give me a ring, probably about 4:00 this afternoon.
Sunday, November 23rd. David phoned and was so very sweet. Nearly proposed.
What are the letters, actually?
ATP.
ATP. Yes, that's something timepieces. Hold on a moment, let me just check this for you. Won't keep you a month.
This is the BBC Home Service. Here is the news.
Hello, sorry to catch you.
Yes,
it's army timepiece, although the fact that a flyer had it obviously doesn't make any difference in the sense that it's a military issue watch. So that means army timepiece, the War Department mark.
Thank you very much.
Okay, good. Glad to have helped.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
The enemy aircraft have been reported over towns on the south coast, the west of England, the North Midlands and the North West, as well as over the London area.
Monday, December 22nd, 1941. Up at 7:30 for breakfast. 9:00, heard radio news. Aircraft of the Coastal Command last night attacked objectives at St. Nazaire.
One of these aircraft is missing.
1:00, received wire. Post Office Telegram, Priority 43, December 22nd, 1941. Miss P. Elmer, 27 Linton Court,
Holland Park Avenue, London, West 11. Regret inform you that Flight Lieutenant David James Fletcher is missing and is believed to have lost his life as a result of air operations on the 21st December. Officer Commanding 201 Squadron.
Tuesday, January 6, 1942. They've given me David's wristwatch. Still on his arm when they pulled him out of the channel. Stopped dead at 3:45. Like him. ATP 55263, it says on the case. Swiss made. Stainless steel back. Heavy little thing. I've had it repaired. Life goes on. February 5th, Tiny came and took me to the Clarendon for a lovely meal with Burgundy. Home by 10:30 and then to bed. He's really grand. Three mm-mms.
It's a bit of a nasty thing to say, I suppose, but all those uniformed men, I mean, who the devil were they all? She seemed to have a thing about uniform, didn't she?
Lieutenant Paul Irwin called to take me to show Doctor's Dilemma. Dinner at Casa Pepe. And walked all the way home. At 1:15, Murray phoned and came by. Talked and then bed.
She did have a whale of a time. I wonder why your mother got married at all.
Saturday, June 4th, 1942. We all went out for dinner on Slough Road. got rid of John with great difficulty. He came back and disconnected the doorbell, but Tiny returned with key, as arranged, and without incident. Two mm-mms. Grand. Monday, July 13th, 5:30, met Captain Lewis Brooks at the Cumberland. Talked in bar and later in the lounge. Very serious. Then home by taxi. Left at the door. Kissed me on cheek. He's very sweet and seems to like me. I hope so.
He was a bombardier, I think, when I met him. Beautiful curly hair, bit foxy, beautiful curly hair, and tall, nice-looking man, you know.
He was very quiet, he's still very quiet, and had a moustache, and it didn't suit him at all. And somebody said to me, well, what do you think about him? I said, well, I suppose he wouldn't be too bad without that dead mouse under his nose.
He came from behind me and asked me to dance. And he had Newfoundland flashes up on his shoulder. The rest of the station were all Canada flashes on the shoulder. But this man had Newfoundland on. He said, well, I come from a country. It's Newfoundland.
Monday, July 13th, 5:30, met Captain Lewis at the Cumberland. Proposed marriage in taxi to Café Royal. Talked for a long while, and he confirmed his love for me. Did not leave until the early hours. Very disturbed, but happy night.
Newfoundland Sailor, part two in this radio series by Dr. Thomas Wood, introducing Commonwealth troops stationed here aiding with the war effort. And here is Dr. Thomas Wood.
On my right is Captain Lewis Brooks of the Newfoundland Liaison Staff. On my left is Corporal Tony Onrat, now of the Canadian Army. What did you say, Captain, if I asked you what's the song above all others that would bring Newfoundland right into this very room?
Well, Doc, I guess it's the Ryans and the Pittman. What do you think, Tony? Is that the one where Ryans and will roll, Captain?
Sure, that's it. Oh, boy, let her go, Captain. She's a dandy. Well, sure, rant and roll all together.
I remember telling some of the WAFs that a Newfoundlander was coming to meet me. Newfoundlander? Well, what's he like? I said, what do you think he's like? Ordinary. How does he speak? I said, what, like we speak. He speaks English. Well, they couldn't believe that. So I told him where we would meet outside the front of Thames House, which was MAP then. And the entire unit walked out the front door and in the back so that they could see Alistair and see what a Newfoundlander looked like.
You know how English people mix, like we mix Australians and New Zealanders. We used to, perhaps we don't so much now, but I mean, used to, didn't we? And you mix Americans and Canadians, sorry, Newfoundland. And not forgetting that English people had only ever seen pictures of America on Hollywood screens and things, and you hear the accent, which we wouldn't have been able to differentiate. We would think of you as American. In your mind, it's all associated with riches, isn't it, and good living.
When Bob told me, well, I live in Newfoundland, you know where Newfoundland is? I expected it to be like the cowboy movies with kind of fences outside of pubs that had swinging doors that you tied horses up to. That was as much as I knew.
What kind of song did you sing?
Well, the squid jigging grounds was one. All about the squid.
That's well, shoot.
Oh, this is the place where the fish.
4 o'clock, met Herbert Masterson at the Grosvenor for tea dance. Met Lewis on the way. He was upset. Herbert proposed at the bus stop. Arranged to see Ring tomorrow.
We always got the impression she must have turned down hundreds, you know, Barbara Cartland, that kind of thing, hundreds of suitors. And Well, perhaps she did. I mean, obviously the men found her very attractive, but maybe she couldn't get them quite as far as the altar if they realised that her background wasn't the same as theirs, because the families would have... I mean, supposing she'd met up with the, I don't know, Earl of Strathmore or something or other, that would be fine, him taking her back to the castle, wouldn't it, the baronial hall. But if he wanted to go back to her place, it would be the laundry at Caxton Road.
So he'd be known by then marrying out of the country?
The no, wouldn't know, would they?
She could fool the friends over there, couldn't she? She was a stranger to them. They would really think that she was a lady of Newfoundland.
Mm.
But we'd all know over here she was no first lady, so she wouldn't be able to keep it out, would she?
Sunday, November 8th. Engagement with Herbert broken off. Terrible quarrel said dreadful things. Feel relieved that it is all over and I am free. Stayed home alone all day. Then phoned Lewis.
That's what I can remember of my sister.
Did we see the wedding invitation?
I say, I don't know if we got one of these. If we did, my sister's got it.
Read it.
The pleasure of your company is requested at the marriage of Phyllis, daughter of the late Mr. and Mrs. P.A. Elmer, and Captain Lewis R. Brooks.
No, he wasn't. You see, that was what hurt him so. I remember now, because he wasn't the late. He was alive. You see what she would do. That's very sad. I remember this now, and how hurt he was about it. Why did she say I was... You know, but what could he say about it? And that's why we didn't go to reception. I know now. I remember now. Because he didn't want to. I mean, how could she introduce him as her father? And yet my dad was a good old dad.
Why would she do that?
Because she didn't want them to know her family.
Responsibility. Say it to yourself a few times. I am making another human being miserable. I don't know if my saying this is going to make any difference at all. You're in denial anyway. And I've had it. You need to see a therapist.
So, I guess the moral of the story is you got recruited in that family into the marriage instead of being able to be a kid in that family. Let me think about that for a minute. Why wouldn't you leave?
Well, where would I go? I didn't have any other family. I mean, my mother always said that her family was dead, which wasn't true. I learned in later life, but I mean, as a child, I didn't know. My father's family, she was estranged from them. Something had happened when I was a little kid, when she'd first stepped off the boat here. I don't really know what it was. So I couldn't go to Aunt so-and-so or Uncle so-and-so. Where would I go if I did run away?
Interesting. So leaving was not a... Ending relationships was not an option you had much experience with.
It was either Harbin Company's wharf or very near there. I guess I was about 10, yes. I remember jumping up and down with excitement and seeing the ship come in.
And we could hear the band playing Here Comes the Bride. And that was funny because some of us had been married for years. I was married a year and a half, and then there were people there with babies. So here come the brides.
And your mother wore a hat. I remember her coming off the ship in high heels and a hat. And I thought this was probably the most glamorous thing I'd ever seen.
She looked down on the wharf and everybody had
gone and being greeted, and there was just this one man standing there, and she looked and she said, "Oh my God, I mean, is this I'm going home kind of thing, you know, because it looks so different in civilian clothing."
Fancy coming off a ship in high heels and a hat. It wasn't like the girl down the street.
We couldn't have been the sort of people they expected their sons and brothers to marry and bring home, because we had been made so different with the war that we weren't, what shall I say, charming daughters-in-law.
We always had the feeling that your mother was very disappointed in the type of family that she came out to, that we didn't quite live up to what perhaps she had either hoped was landed gentry or had been led to believe was landed gentry, although I don't know. But we always felt there was that sense of not quite being what she was either used to or expected us to be.
They didn't really understand, I don't think, what it was, what we expected.
Is it because they hadn't been through the war?
I think that was a lot of it. No, they didn't fear for their life every night. But it, no, all the dreams we had that we were going to make a new life and it was going to be splendid, they all went. No, Newfoundland wasn't for me. It wasn't that dream. I think the first fortnight, I knew it couldn't be.
Monday, April 1st, 1946. Very cold and snow. Stayed in all day. Tuesday, April 2nd. Stayed in all day. Very cold and slushy. Snow everywhere. Wednesday, April 3rd. Stayed in all day. Thursday, April 4th. Stayed in all day. Friday, April 5th. Rain, hail, ice, snow, and slush everywhere. Stayed in all day. Wednesday, May 2nd, 1946. They accuse me of not trying to like people here. Gosh, but I feel a long way from home now. How I hate it here. But who cares how I feel? Having to live under such awful conditions and the weather so terribly bleak, what can they expect?
This homesickness, I think, was also a part of grieving. And I think it was kind of a post-traumatic experience that we were having that nobody knew about or nobody realised. I don't think it was the quite as bad as we thought and how we blamed Newfoundland and we blamed people and that for it. I think we were going through what they now call a post-traumatic syndrome of the war and leaving home and that kind of thing. I really do. But because we didn't, it wasn't recognised then, was it? Nothing like that was recognised.
And, you know, there were always family arguments. And nobody really understood how you felt. They didn't understand why I wanted to go home. They didn't understand why I wasn't happy. I was very sad.
I felt if they'd separated, I guess, they would have...
They what?
If they'd separated, I think they couldn't have been any worse off.
Mm.
But they stayed together for me.
Is that what they told you?
Yeah. Well, that's what my mother told me.
Your mom said that?
Mm.
If it wasn't for you, I'd be gone.
Oh, yeah, my mother used to say, if it wasn't for me, she would be gone, back to England.
So the 8-year-old says, I'd never do this. I'd never continually threaten to leave a relationship.
I guess.
Clever shit. So you promise yourself that you'd never keep this threat of abandonment going, and so you never do leave a relationship. Interesting little twist there.
I'm desperately unhappy. No future. No present.
If you leave a relationship, you're injuring somebody else.
I am keen for divorce.
So do you think, how would you have gotten by if she had left? If she had stopped all the talk and left.
To ship back with me. Sewing machine. Gramophone with records.
I wonder.
Coffee table.
I imagine.
Radio.
I would be more like some of my friends who...
Linen in boxes.
Are able to... I mean, I'm...
Red mat. Ironing board.
No, lots of people who are divorced.
Clothes and shoes.
Who don't exactly torture themselves about it. Seems to be something that they can handle and live through. I think I'd be more like that.
I gotta quit for tonight. Have you been listening to your tapes in between sessions?
You asked for my commitment. You expected me to be committed to you through all of this crap, and you're annoyed with me now because I can't do that? I can't go on any longer like this. It's over. It's over. Bye.